Welcome to Torah Te'amecha Parsha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Chana Meira, and today I'll be learning Parshat Toldot. Parshat Toldot is a very short parsha. It's only four prakim. It's not even a full four prakim because the first and last parak are just sections. It's 106 psukim, and it evolves around three main stories. The story of the birth of Yaakov and Esav and the subsequent selling of the Bechora, the birthright, the travels of Yitzchak and Rivka in Gerar in the land of the Plishtim, and then the whole saga where Yaakov steals the brachas from Esau. And because the seven aliyahs cut into these three stories, and I want to just look at the overarching theme, we're not going to go aliyah by aliyah. We're just going to look at the actual stories. And what I would like to explore is our overarching question when examining how Yaakov took the bracha from Esau. We're going to ask ourselves, does the end justify the means? In order to truly understand what the result was of this whole episode, we're going to look at the story through the angle of the married couple, Yitzchak and Rivka. We're going to look at it through the angle of parent and child, looking at Yitzchak and Rivka's relationship to Esav and Yaakov respectively, and then through the lens of the actual siblings, Yaakov and Esav. So these three lenses together are going to give us a view of analyzing the story and trying to understand why it happened the way it did and was it worth it. So if you look at the very beginning of the parasha, which I said is the middle of a perek, it cuts into the perek that is telling us all about Yishmael's descendants, and it starts our parasha, Ele toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham holidet Yitzchak. So after telling us all about Yishmael's family, it turns to tell us about Yitzchak's family, and all it tells us is that he's the son of Avram, which means he is the main inheritor. He is next in the chain of this legacy, carrying on Hashem's promise and investment into Avraham. But it tells us two more things. We're going to see, especially in the middle narrative, that Yitzchak lives his life trying to continue Avram's work. He's not innovating. He's taking what Avram started and bringing it to the next level. His life mirrors a lot of the challenges that Avraham had, and he works through them similar to Avraham, but a little bit better, a little bit more refined. The last thing we learn from this is that Yitzchak lived a very protected life. He was the son of Avraham, and Avraham guarded and protected him together with Sarah from any possible negative influence. They made sure that his chinuch was perfect. Anyone who might even be a hint of a bad influence was quickly removed. Yitzchak had no exposure to evil. In contrast, we're going to see about Yitzchak's wife, Rivka. Vayihi Yitzchak ben Arba'im Shana bekachto et Rivka. He was 40 years old when he took Rivka. And who is Rivka? Bat Besuel Ha'arami mipadan Aram. The daughter of Besuel Ha'arami from Padan Aram. So Arami could mean from Aram, or it could mean the sly one. Achot Lavan Ha'arami. Lo Leisha. So it's stressed that her father and brother were extreme tricksters. They were con men. She was exposed to every possible trick in the book of how to cheat people, so she could spot a con artist a mile away. So we have a very interesting relationship. The father is very sheltered with no exposure to evil, and the mother is very worldly. And not only that, we remember what the Netziv taught us last week, that Rivka always felt in awe of Yitzchak. When she saw him davening, she covered herself with a veil and lowered herself off the camel because she felt inadequate, not on the same level as Yitzchak. And that's why Rivka can never talk to Yitzchak the same way Sarah can confront Avram, and Rachel later can confront Yaakov. She always feels like she has to work around him. She can't just approach him. Every stage of the way, when there's something to say, she rather does something about it instead of talking about it. So we see the first time where Yitzchak is undergoing a similar experience to Avram. His wife can't have children. But whereas Avram accepted it, even Yaakov accepted it when his wife couldn't have children, Yitzchak is the only one who actually davens. It says, Vayater. He pleaded and he begged with Hashem, and Hashem answered him. And Rivka is pregnant. But her pregnancy is not normal. She does not realize she's having twins, but she can feel something moving around inside her, causing her tremendous discomfort. She doesn't go to Yitzchak to ask what's happening. She doesn't even go to Avram to ask what's happening. She goes to the yeshiva of Shem and Ever, and she receives a prophecy that you're carrying two nations in your womb who will be fighting for world dominance. So of course they're not going to be sitting placidly in utero. The most notable thing about this prophecy is that Rivka doesn't tell anyone about it. She doesn't tell Yitzchak. She doesn't even tell her midwife. So when she gives birth, it says, Vehine, surprise, twins. No one was expecting this. So she goes throughout her life knowing about the prophecy, and Yitzchak doesn't. So the way they view their children will obviously be very different. When they're born, we immediately see that they're very different. One is very hairy and red. The other one isn't described by his looks, but by his actions, holding on to the heel of his brother. As they grow up, we notice a difference in their personalities. It says that Esav is Ish Yodea Tzayit. He's a man who knows trapping, both people and animals. Ish Sadeh, and he's also a man of the field. But he's not a man of a field like Yitzchak is. You know, Yitzchak went lasuach basadeh. To Yitzchak, the field is a place of his bodedut to connect to God. A field is where he nurtures everything that Avram planted and brings it to fruition. That's why he is associated with the field, and he's a farmer. For Esav, a man of the field means finding things alone, unopened, defenseless, ready to be hunted, both animals and people. So superficially, Yitzchak thinks he has something in common with Esav. They both love the outdoors, but for diametrically opposed reasons. In contrast, Yaakov is called Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. He is a wholesome man who dwells in tents. Rivka is also in the Ohel because Yitzchak brought her to Sarah's tent. So both Yitzchak and Esav spend their time in the field, and Rivka and Yaakov spend their time in tents. And this foreshadows what we're going to see in the next pasuk. It says, V'yehav Yitzchak et Esav, kitzayit befiv. Yitzchak loved Esav. Past tense, because he was a hunter with his mouth. V'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. But Rivka, continuous presence, loves Yaakov. So we learn a number of things from this. The first thing we learn is that a parent who showers a child with love but no discipline will eventually come to despise that child. Because we have to give our children discipline. We have to reproach them when they do things wrong. We have to instruct them on the right way. The second thing we see from this is that Rabbi Avraham, who is the son of the Rambam, comments that both parents loved both children. All parents loved their children. But each one had an affinity to the child they spent the most time with. Because it's human nature that whoever you have common interests and you spend time with, you'll have more of a connection. So Yitzchak was very invested in Esav because he was the firstborn. And they both had this affinity over the field. And also it says that Esav was tzayid befiv. He used to trap him with his mouth. He would have all these intelligent conversations, making him sound like he was very learned. And Yitzchak, who was more straightforward and sheltered, he fell for it. Rivka had the advantage of the prophecy, which she never shared with Yitzchak. And she also knew she could tell a con man, having grown up with him. So she didn't really take Esav's claims of righteousness too seriously. But she was very close to Yaakov. It doesn't say why. There's no reason given. But we can assume they both spent time in the tent. They spent time together. This made them close. And we learn a lesson in the Torah. Even though it might be natural for our parents to feel more of an affinity with a certain child, you should never, ever show it. Not to the child, not to the sibling. It causes huge problems. It's going to cause problems with Yaakov and Esav. It's going to cause problems with Yosef and his brothers. We never show favoritism. And then what about the relationship between Esav and Yaakov? So we don't see any real closeness between them. We just see one interaction. Esav comes home one day and he is famished. And he says to Yaakov, Hale'iteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh. The word Hale'iteni, you don't see any other place in Tanakh. We see it in Mishnah. It's a word for gorging yourself. It's like he's saying, stuff me up with this red, red stuff. And Yaakov, I mean, a normal sibling, if you're busy cooking something and your sibling wants some, I would imagine you would share. But Yaakov seems a little bit revolted by this. The Midrash tells us that he was cooking the meal as a mourner's meal to comfort Yitzchak, who had just lost Abraham. But even if it was a normal meal, he was a bit repulsed by Esav's wildness, his primitiveness. So he decided to get something out of it. He said, well, then sell me the right to be the firstborn. Why does he ask for that? Because Yaakov is forward-thinking. He's thinking about the future. The right to be the firstborn is talking about in the future, the firstborn would serve Hashem, doing the avodah in the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash. And this was something he wanted very much, being more spiritual. Esav viewed the right to Bechor in a very different way. He thought the Bechor is when my father dies and he divides the property, the Bechor gets double. I'm a hunter. The likelihood of me outliving my father is slim. I'd probably die on the hunt way before my father does. So I don't need this Bechor, but I'm hungry. I need my food. He shows he's a very in-the-moment person. His motto is eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow I'll probably get killed on a hunt. And so Yaakov realizes that Esav, even though he was born first, doesn't have what it takes to carry on the legacy of Avraham. The promises Hashem gave Avraham are all future-orientated, and Esav is not interested in the future. And therefore, Yaakov orchestrates a promise out of Esav that the Bechor belongs to him. There are no witnesses, nothing is signed, they just seal the deal over a meal. They're the only ones who know about it. And it's interesting that Rivka and Yitzchak never refer to them as the Bechor and the younger, they refer to them as the biggest and the smallest. But later, when Esav and Yaakov are both going to come in front of Yitzchak, they're both going to say that they are the Bechor. So it's interesting that Esav doesn't keep his word, whereas Yitzchak and Rivka sort of intuitively know that the Bechor is not who they think it is. So we fast forward through all the time that Yitzchak is in Gerar. That's the middle narrative. We're not going into it now. The only thing to really take out of that is how devoted Yitzchak is to carrying on his father's legacy. He digs up his father's well. He follows in the path of his father. He's very committed to everything that his father planted, he helps grow, which means he's very invested in who he's going to give the bracha, because he spent his whole life building on Avram's work and he wants his children to continue that. So he's taking the brachas very, very seriously. The other thing we need to know about this is Yitzchak's method is patient persistence. Anytime he meets with confrontation, whether Avimelech, the king of Gerar, or the Plishtim, the way he stands up to evil is just by quiet consistency. You can't stop him. You don't want him to dig a well here, so he'll move and build a well there, right? He just keeps on doing what he needs to do. He's very persistent. In his quiet way, he's not a pushover. And this is important to understand, because when you read the scene of the stealing of the brachas, it looks like Yitzchak is blind, an easy target, naive, and we said he wasn't as exposed to evil, but we see by the way that he handles Avimelech, the king of Gerar, and he handles the people who challenge him, in his quiet way he can stand up for himself, he can be assertive, and this is something to keep in mind. So now we come to the climax, the main story of the stealing of the brachot. And the stealing of the brachot is framed, very interesting, with Esav's marriages. When Esav turns 40, he decides to be just like his father and get married, except unlike his father, who Eliezer to take an oath to not marry him off to a Canaanite woman, he marries two Canaanite women from the Chittim, which caused Yitzchak and Rivka tremendous pain. And it says that Yitzchak actually became blind from his daughters-in-law. The Midrash tells us they used to offer incense to their idols. This caused him to be blind. But the description of a blind father means somebody who's blind to his son's bad behavior. We have a similar blindness with Eli in Sefer Shmuel, that he can't see his son's evil behavior. And he thinks he's going to die, and he wants to give his sons the bracha. He wants to pass on the legacy. So he wants to give it to Esav. And we need to understand, why is this? On the one hand, he did have a relationship with him. It could be that he recognized him as a hunter, and he recognized him as a go-getter. And to his mind, he felt that the person who would be building up the nation had to be a person who could be aggressive and dominant and conquer enemies in a physical way. He didn't value his own power, the power of the Jewish people, to quietly and consistently persist in the right path, doing what they meant to do, which is way more powerful than empires that come and go. So that's why he asked Esav to please go and bring him some meat, because the merit of Kibbutz Av would be a merit for him to earn the bracha. But he's acknowledging his hands-on earthy ways. He's saying, I'm giving you this blessing because I want you to take care of the family. You're taking care of me. I want you to take care of your brother. Rivka overhears this, and she doesn't for one second think that Esav will utilize the brachas in the way that Yitzchak thinks he will. Now, if she was Sarah, she would have confronted Yitzchak, but she's not. She's Rivka. She can't talk to him to his face. So she has to resort to a trick. So what she does is she convinces Yaakov to dress up as Esav, wear Esav's clothes, cover his hands with skins of goats, and pretend to be Esav, which Yaakov complies with hesitancy, but he does comply, and he receives the brachas. The brachas are for financial success, political success, dominance, anything that you would imagine Esav really should get because of the nature of his personality. And then he leaves just as Esav comes. You should read it inside the pasuk. The build-up and the suspense is very well described. But when Esav finds out that he lost the bracha, he cries a terrible and bitter cry. And he says, first Yaakov took the bechor from me, and now the brachas. And it says, Vayecherad Yitzchak, charada gedola. Yitzchak trembled, a terrible trembling, because he suddenly realized, if naive, innocent, Yaakov could trick him, how much more so sophisticated Esau? And he suddenly realized for the first time how mistaken he had been and how close he had come to giving the bracha to the wrong person. So what was the fallout from all of this? What happened to each character? So interesting, Yitzchak does not regret. In fact, he calls back Yaakov and he again gives him the brachas to reaffirm that he is the one who should have them. And he gives Esav a second prize bracha, which is not as good, and Esav is not so impressed. But Esav gets the message, and it says at the end of the whole story that he takes a third wife from the daughter of Yishmael to try to placate his parents. And it never mentions that he's angry at Yitzchak or even at Rivka. What happens to Rivka? Well, Rivka overhears Esav plotting to kill Yaakov, and she quickly sends Yaakov to go to her family in Paddan Aram, but she never sees Yaakov again. She put the plan into motion, but she never gets to see the Nachas, her grandchildren. She spends the rest of her life with Esav and his non-Jewish wives and their non-Jewish children, worshipping idols, and she dies in quiet. We don't even hear about her death. But the one who really, really paid the heaviest price of all was Yaakov. And it wasn't even his initiative. He just went along with it. But he pays in a number of ways. First of all, when it says that Esav heard that he'd lost the bracha, he cried out, Tzaka gedola umara. And we have that same phraseology when Mordechai hears about the plot of Haman. Hundreds of years later, the descendant of Yaakov cries out with the same cry when the descendant of Esav plots to kill the Jews. There's a very clear midah keneged midah there. And it carries on. Just like Yaakov pretended to be the older brother when he was the younger brother, Lavan is going to take his older daughter and pretend that she is the younger daughter to trick Yaakov. Just like Yaakov covered his hands with goat skin and pretended to be Esav, Yaakov's sons are going to dip a coat in goat's blood and pretend that Yosef had died. So Yaakov is going to pay the price again and again throughout the rest of his life for what he did. And so this goes back to our question, was it worth it? Do the ends justify the means? And the truth is, I'm not going to give you an answer. I'm giving you two perspectives. On the one hand, every time we cause people pain, there is always a price to pay. The Ramban said that because Sarah chased away Hagar and made her cry, the children of Hagar, Yishmael, will make the children of Sarah cry. There's a definite consequence. And we see the consequence that Yaakov pays. And yet Sarah did it anyway, knowing the price. Rivka does it anyway, knowing the price. Because our avot and our imahot, our forefathers, did not look at the today. They looked at the future. And any action that they undertook, they weighed up till the end of time what would be the consequences. And in their mind, they felt that even though there would be such a fallout, it was still worth it given the benefit or given the protection that they wanted to afford their child. We are not on the level of our avot and imahot. So when we have these difficult decisions to make, the first thing we should learn is obviously it's so much better to have open communication when you can. If Rivka could have just spoken directly to Yitzchak, if Yaakov would have had a relationship with Yitzchak, things would have been very, very different. So the first thing we should try as much as we can as families is to improve our relationships with each other. But sometimes you are put in a situation where you can't just talk straight, even though you wish you could. So you have to weigh up the consequences. Is the result of what you want worth the pain, worth the suffering that both you and the person you are inflicting it on will get? And you have to really, really think carefully, because sometimes we just delude ourselves and think, oh, it's worth it. I'm going to close my eyes and do it. But there's always a price involved. And bracha is not just having nice things. Bracha means that you are part of a calling. You are part of this line of Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, an eternal covenant with Hashem. You have to weigh up, is the pain I'm going to cause, whoever it is, worth it? Will it jeopardize me being part of this line of bracha? Or will it enable me to be a part of it? And that's a very personal decision that we all have to weigh up and think of every day of our lives. And no one can really give you that answer. You have to be honest with yourself. But it's a calculation that you really, truly have to make. So with that in mind, I wish you all a wonderful week.